Hello, everyone. My name is Anastasia Bowden, and I'm an attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. I sue the government for a living, so I was a little surprised they asked me to introduce this panel of my potential future opposing counsel. In fact, on the plane ride over, I received an extension request from the Tennessee AG's office, which I will note I did not oppose. But in all seriousness, it's my great pleasure to be here and to recognize the important work that these offices do and to introduce a jurist whose dedication to the rule of law and public service has distinguished her in the judiciary, and that's the moderator of this panel, Judge Britt C. Grant. Judge Grant's career is a testament to excellence across legal fields. A graduate of Stanford Law School and president of her school's Federalist Society chapter, she began her legal journey clerking for then-Judge Brett Kavanaugh on the UC Court of Appeals for the DC Circuit. Judge Grant later practiced law in the Washington, D.C. office of Kirkland & Ellis before serving as the Solicitor General of Georgia. Judge Grant was appointed to the 11th Circuit in August of 2018 after serving first as a justice on the Supreme Court of Georgia. Recently, her name appeared beside her former boss, Brett Kavanaugh, on President Trump's Supreme Court shortlist. Judge Grant's commitment to law is matched only by her commitment to public service and dedication to upholding the foundational principles of our constitutional system. Please scan your program if you want CLE credit. Don't forget, I was told to remind you all. And join me in welcoming the Honorable Britt C. Grant.
Thank you for that exceedingly generous introduction. I'll make sure that you can hear me. There it is. I guess I'll need to lean forward. Well, good afternoon. I'm pleased to be here moderating this panel, Special Solicitude, Lawsuits Against the Executive Branch and Their Futures. The panel description explains that for the last 4 years, state attorneys general have brought many significant lawsuits against the Biden administration, and that is certainly true. But as a former Solicitor General for the state of Georgia, I can tell you firsthand that state attorneys general have also brought many lawsuits against the Obama administration and during the first term of the Trump administration. Indeed, the phrase special solicitude comes from Massachusetts versus EPA, a case brought against the Bush administration. No doubt, however, the scale and frequency of this litigation and even amicus briefing has increased. So too have questions about how state-led litigation fits within our constitutional structure, whether from a federalism or separation of powers perspective, how policy shifts between presidential administrations affect states and their litigation, the appropriate scope of administrative decision-making, and the proper nature of remedies in such suits. I cannot think of a better group of panelists to help us discuss these questions and hopefully disagree a little bit about their answers. So with that, I will get to the bios, which I was instructed by all panelists to be very brief. So I'm following your orders, gentlemen. First, we have Mr. Elliot Geiser, who's the Solicitor General of Ohio. Before his appointment to that role, Mr. Geiser worked at Jones Day. He was before that, he was a management consultant and also a graduate fellow for anti-poverty studies at a research institution here in Washington, D.C. We also have Mr. Eric Olson, who's a former Solicitor General of the state of Colorado. He's now a partner at Olson and Grimsley. He previously served as a trial lawyer for Bartlett Beck for 16 years and had a very wide and robust practice there, and now currently in his own firm. Last but not least, we have Mr. Jonathan Scrimeti, the current Attorney General of the state of Tennessee. Before his current role, General Scrimeti served as chief counsel to Governor Bill Lee and chief deputy attorney general to his predecessor, Tennessee Attorney General Herbert Slattery. And before working for the state of Tennessee, General Scrimeti was a partner at Butler Snow LLP in Memphis, as well as a federal prosecutor. So I'll ask you to welcome our panelists before we get started. Mr. Geiser, you're up.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction, and thank you all for being here. Thank you to the Federalist Society. It is an honor to be able to speak to you. With no intent at cultural appropriation, I would like to begin with a mountaintop view, or perhaps that's what I chose to call this because a burning river view, being from Ohio, is not nearly as eloquent sounding. and then to turn to a perhaps daring idea. The mountaintop view, start with what states are. States are semi-sovereigns, quasi-sovereigns, part of a system of dual sovereignty. And people oftentimes get this wrong when they say that the federal government is a creature of the states. That's not quite right. Instead, the federal government is a creature of the people operating in their states. The states are a set of political institutions. And like the Declaration of Independence says, those political institutions derive their just power from the consent of the governed, and they have a job to do, a very important one. It's to secure the rights of the people that they represent. And sometimes that scheme of political institutions that is created in our regime falls out of joint. Sometimes the federal government doesn't stay within its mandate and does so in a way that prejudices the interests of the people that the political institutions in the state are tasked with representing. One such institution is the Attorney General's office. And my boss, Dave Yost, has tasked me and others with looking out for those interests in litigation against the federal government. That's the broad mountaintop view of what states should do. And it only gives me some pleasure to say that I looked at the number of active matters where Ohio has led or joined litigation against the federal government, and the number came to 43. 43 suits where Ohio is now currently engaged in litigation against the federal government. And most of this litigation takes the form of Administrative Procedure Act rights. States themselves, those political institutions that are arranged in the states, they are oftentimes the object of regulation by the federal government, and they also step into the shoes, in many instances, of the people and the industries that they represent. So, if you look at what that litigation involves, what are those 43 suits? To give you a little bit of a smattering of what they might be, and also to return to the Declaration of Independence. The best part of the Declaration of Independence is not that hortatory start, the beginning to the average person living in the colonies in 1776. When that document was read out over the Liberty Trees and by the Liberty Bells and in the town squares, people would have gotten into the sort of political rally style cheer for the long list of 18 he has statements. He has the federal crown doing things that violate the rights. Well, this federal government has attempted to regulate the carbon on our highways, attempted to change the definition of sex in our schools, in our own employment arrangements. It has attempted to place one state, California, as the master over emissions policy for all the other states, and it has attempted to regulate our investments, sometimes the state's investments themselves, and to change the relationship that those investments have to returns by imposing climate disclosure requirements that are quite onerous. This is a smattering of the litigation that's involved, but where do we go from here? I think that if you look at the past ping-ponging set of relationships between the federal government, litigation, and states, this is not advice to the federal government. I'm not in touch with any of those people. This is just me musing aloud that if I happen to be in the federal government relatively soon, I would look at this suite of litigation. And I would look at two different conditions that that litigation might have, and then I would read one oral argument transcript from the Supreme Court. So the two conditions, then the transcript. I would look at the rules that satisfy two conditions. They're currently challenged and pending and briefed in circuit courts or the Supreme Court, and or the effect of those rules happen to be stayed. And I would consider whether or not in a world where Chevron deference is no longer the rule of the road, it might make sense to allow some courts to actually reach final judgment and declare what the law actually means in the relationship between the federal government and the states and the relationship between Congress's statutes and the agencies that are tasked with effectuating those statutes. Because perhaps that ping-ponging effect might be arrested by the judiciary being able to actually conclude whether the Securities Exchange Commission in 1934 was tasked with regulating climate emissions, or perhaps whether Title IX intended to allow men to compete in women's sports. And so I would say, look carefully at whether or not you want to accomplish what happened, and that's where I turn to the transcript of oral argument in a case called Arizona versus San Francisco. The court ultimately dismissed as improvidently granted, but I think that the transcript there is quite interesting, and I will take the moment of personal privilege to quote from my former boss at that argument. Speaking to Deputy Solicitor General Fletcher, he said, "I congratulate whoever it is in the Justice Department on the executive branch who devised this strategy and was able to implement it with military precision to effect the removal of the issue from our docket and sidestep notice and comment rulemaking." And I think what happened there is a number of cases that the states had filed against the previous Trump administration, the Department of Justice acquiesced in many of those injunctions. Sure, fine,
That's great. But they didn't allow them to go to final judgment. These were often preliminary injunctions. The courts hadn't actually reached a final conclusion. And then they used that to simply eliminate the rule without going through notice and comment. I don't know if that's going to work this time. And I think that there was considerable agitation among many members of the federal judiciary about whether that actually comports with the Administrative Procedures Act and with the design of our constitutional structure. So I would say maybe in some instances where the state has the federal government down on the mat, maybe let the clock run to 10.
Well, as a former Solicitor General and not a current one, I can speak, I think, a little more candidly about this. And I think there has been a huge uptick, both of states recognizing the important role they play in our democracy and in the AG Scrimeti excluded as he's appointed, with a lot of political appointed attorney generals using this forum for political gain and virtue signaling. And I think that what I saw in my 5 years as Colorado Solicitor General was states as states often standing up and addressing real issues that matter to them in their relationship with the federal government, and states as political actors disagreeing with their federal government about light bulbs, washing machines, or in Colorado's case, how much of the United States Postal Service fleet was electric. And I think those are the kind of things where states are not particularly well suited to participate in this discussion. And I want to talk a little bit about what I think, where the most value comes from the state participation, both in getting the best outcomes and in honoring what Elliot talked about in terms of the way that our constitutional structure is set up. And I'll talk about sort of two specific cases that I was involved in. The first is, and speaking of ping-ponging, the Waters of the United States rule that goes back and forth from time to time. You know, Congress initially punted on the scope of the Clean Water Act and left it for others to decide, and the others, the EPA and the Corps of Engineers, have changed their minds repeatedly on what Waters of the United States means. But it has real consequences in the states. And in Colorado specifically, we did not set up a regulatory regime to allow for permitting, to allow for the normal machinery of development, of restoration, of just normal engagement with water systems that most governments do, because we relied on the federal government. The Corps of Engineers under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act was a permitting agency, and if someone wanted to, you know, disturb the waters of the United States, which almost you have to do if you want to do any kind of development or run a farm and make improvements, then the Corps was where you went to. But with a very quick removal of the scope of federal authority, we were left in Colorado with about, I think it was 600,000 miles of streams where there was no effective regulatory body that could allow for normal commerce, agriculture, et cetera, to take place. And so we raised our hand and we filed our own suit against the federal government and said, look, you can do what you want, but give us some time. You can't do it this fast. And we argued that it should be more expansive, but it was more focused on us as a state having a real problem created by this quick administrative change. And we were the only state that succeeded in getting an injunction. So for a while in the state, the old rule applied. We were able to stand up a regulatory system that now is in place and was able to manage that. But it really affected our interest as a state. And we went to the courts and said, you know, we have a problem, please fix it. And they said, sure, here's your remedy. The district court agreed. The 10th Circuit did not. But that gave us the time to stand up our own system. In the second series of cases were all the litigation over Trump's border wall. You know, I think all of us would agree that when the federal government is coming and taking your state land to build something without following your rules, that's a different situation than, say, in Colorado, where you look far distant away and say, I disagree with this federal policy. And I think the courts rightly recognized a lot of those differences. And so I think that as you think about what special solicitude means, states are huge. They are consumers of consumer products. They buy a lot of light bulbs, even washing machines. They buy a lot of cars. They have their own interests in doing things their way, but they are not necessarily, I mean, to Elliot's point about being an employer, you know, the state as an employer isn't necessarily different than anyone else as an employer in some basic ways. They have to follow basic rules and requirements. But thinking about how do we talk about special solicitude where we're thinking about what the state really has skin in the game, where it really is the state as a state, I think that's where things should play out. And I'll follow up on a point Elliot made about using litigation to bypass notice and comment. I think no one has really engaged in that kind of strategic opportunity with great skill yet, which is surprising because I think there's a lot of opportunity for mischief in both directions. And I think our current doctrines and systems are not set up to deal with how do you basically take a litigation midstream, get a court order that bypasses a lot of the typical notice and comment processes, and you know, how do we fix that in a way where you allow for courts to do their thing and the Administrative Procedure Act to have some meaning is a real open question. And it's particularly an open question in circumstances where I would say there is a lack of full input. I mean, I was really struck, and I forget what opinion it was, by Chief Justice Roberts on standing, but basically saying, look, we can solve this problem by having more amicus briefs come at our court. We don't need to defer to an agency. And I think, you know, one of the it's not a secret, but one of the surprises to me joining the SG ranks was what goes in an amicus brief. You are unconstrained by the record. You are unconstrained by the rules of evidence. You are unconstrained by anything other than political fallout or judicial ire. And so, but there's no notice, there's no requirement of notice, there's no requirement of disclosure. You just put what you want in the amicus brief. And I think there needs to be a better way of figuring this out. And I think states are really equipped to do that because states, unlike a lot of private litigants, have political accountability, have the ability, more disclosure, have the expertise to fully participate. And I think the other thing that we're going to see is that the regulatory uncertainty created by increased state involvement and challenging of light bulb rules and you know, SEC rules, et cetera, is going to be, and the court has signaled an openness to this so far, is that it's not just going to be California on clean on cars. It's now California on bacon, right? National Pork Producers Council said California can set rules for the country on how pigs must be raised. In Colorado, we have a similar rule about eggs. You know, if you want to sell an egg in Colorado, you have to make sure that chicken has access to, you know, air and can't be in a cage. And no one raises chickens just to sell in Colorado. They raise to sell nationally. And I think a derivative fallout from this special solicitude is going to increase a different state agency than the Attorney General, but state power to regulate things that we normally look to the federal government to regulate. And so I think those are going to be some real changes. If this trend continues forward, we're going to be, you know, here in Washington, D.C., California and Texas are going to dictate things that we eat, what we buy, et cetera. And you know, you can query what's the better system, but I think that's what's coming.
Well, it's hard to follow up two solicitors general because they spend a lot more time actually doing law. And in the AG position, you have to have the kind of mountaintop view all the time. And it gets dangerous if you start to get down and do granular things. It makes a lot more work for your staff. So I try not to do that too much. But I am very concerned with the structure of government. And we have a government at both the federal and state level that, as Elliot said, is established by the people. That's where the law comes from. The states and the federal government are both creatures of the American people, and they have been created as a means of checking the concentration of power. That was the great villain at the time of the founding. Separation of powers is the most fundamental principle of the American structure of government. and everything is supposed to work in our system to constrain the power of any given individual. We have different powers in different branches at the federal level. We have the states where most of the governing power is supposed to reside as the inferior governments, and everyone is supposed to work to check the other parts of government. Over about the last 110 years or so, we have seen the increasing metastasization of the federal government in the executive branch. The administrative state has grown and grown, and there's a reason for that. There's this ongoing conflict between the more popularly accountable means of government, which is what we're supposed to have with the documents that govern us say we should have, and the much more efficient, cleaner and quieter way of letting experts govern us, which you see in both the administrative state and for a while with judicial activism. Both of those are vehicles for taking decision-making away from the people, from avoiding popular accountability, and from letting the smart people decide how things should run and making everybody else deal with it. Now, in the long run, this is an extraordinarily corrosive approach to running a country. People start to feel like the law is something that's inflicted on them, not something that they're actively participating in creating. They feel like they are alienated from the law, and the governmental institutions that are supposed to reflect a process of constructive disagreement in which everybody is able to participate become these shadowy bureaucrats micromanaging their lives with no recourse. When Congress passes a law that's stupid, you can yell at your congressman, you can vote for a different congressman, you can give money to elect congresspeople from around the country that agree with you. When agencies make decisions you don't like, unless you're a very sophisticated player, you can yell at your congressman and he can tell you that there's not really anything he can do about it. And so over time, we've seen an increasing concentration of power in the administrative state. Lawsuits from the states against the federal government are a means of checking that. It's the structure of our constitutional system reasserting itself. The states have interests in exercising their own powers, which are not enumerated. There's a general police power that the states have. And the broader the authority exercised by the administrative state, the less room the states have to govern. Every time a federal agency passes a rule that further inhibits the ability of the states to create their own rules, that's hurting state sovereignty. That's removing the ability of the state to be self-governing. It's depriving the people of the state of the republican form of government that the Constitution guarantees them. And so the states took a while to recognize the problem here, but have started to push back and push back emphatically. We hit a tipping point, and all of a sudden the states on both sides are consistently reasserting their prerogatives, largely through litigation against the federal executive branch. But it's not just a matter of reasserting state sovereignty and the state's role in our federal system. These are also vehicles that let the other branches of the federal government push back against the executive branch, which has expanded to infringe on their prerogatives. The judiciary can rein in an executive branch run amok through this state litigation. They can't sua sponte say something's unconstitutional, that some federal action overreaches. But when the states get active as litigants, they're in a structural position to push back against the federal government's executive branch in a way that lets the judicial branch assert its prerogatives as well, to say what the law is, to draw lines about the scope of federal enforcement authority. A lot of our litigation has related to the regulatory state, APA challenges, major questions. You know, the non-delegation doctrine is still floating around out there. Schechter Poultry is still good law, and we're going to bring it back at some point, I hope. And there are a lot of procedural considerations as well, but it's not just about reining in APA actions and reining in rulemaking. There are also some other abuses of the constitutional structure that have been more and more localized in the federal administrative agencies. The biggest one, the area where I suspect we're going to see the most intense litigation over the coming decade, is the spending clause. In Students for Fair Admissions, we have a Supreme Court that says if something's unconstitutional to do directly, then you can't do it indirectly. At the same time, we have enumerated powers, and we have a spending clause that gives Congress the ability to do a complete end run around that, and we've seen more and more, gives agencies the opportunity to read something anodyne or ambiguous that Congress has written and create incredibly complicated and onerous regimes that they inflict on the states through the process of bribery. I mean, we had a process in Tennessee looking at whether we could reject the Department of Education's funding because there were so many strings attached to it. And at the end of the day, it's really hard to say no to billions and billions of dollars. There's an incredible incentive there for the states to do whatever the federal government tells them to do when the money is attached. So I think we're going to see a lot of litigation focused on that because that's a way that the administrative agencies have started to really exercise power that they should not constitutionally have. And the other area where I hope we see increased litigation is the Commerce Clause. Wickard versus Filburn is still out there. We've seen people nibbling at it, but it's been largely resistant to any efforts to rein it in. But it is the justification for a tremendous amount of federal activity that seems very inconsistent with the vision of the structure of government. It creates opportunities for federal micromanagement, and federal micromanagement is bad. We've seen these culture war issues absolutely on fire, where people are incredibly passionate about them, where people want to ensure that the folks who disagree with them are just crushed, right? And it doesn't matter which issue, on both sides, there are people who vehemently want to assert their will over everybody. But these are issues that are not fundamentally federal issues. So for instance, with Dobbs, abortion was driving a huge amount of the political activity at the federal level. You have ping-ponging between administrations. Abortion is great, abortion is horrible, abortion is great, abortion is horrible. In terms of the regulation, you had a purported constitutional right that has since been identified as not found anywhere in the Constitution. And in Dobbs, the court said, this is a state issue, the state should decide. And that's the way it is for a lot of these cultural issues. California is wrong about many things, but as a state of self-governing people, there are things that California is allowed to be wrong about. And whether we like it or not, it is not our job to seize power and do everything we can to make California and Californians conform to our will. There are some things that the federal government must do. There are essential federal duties, like protecting the country, like determining who is lawfully allowed into the country. There are infrastructural, commerce roles, standards roles. There needs to be a robust and competent federal government. But at the same time, there is room for the states to do a lot of governing, and it's better for us when we don't bring every fight up to the national level, nationalize it, and particularly when we don't ping-pong back and forth between regulatory overreach to immiserate people on the other side while we have the chance to, and then hunker down and have the same thing done back to us. It removes the ability of our country to govern itself well when we're doing too much at the federal level and not letting the states take some of the conflict off the table so that we can disagree about things that the federal government can meaningfully work through and give them problems to solve rather than intractable problems that are going to be much more ably handled at the state level with a diversity of opinions across the country. Suing the federal government lets us atomize the fighting. When we win, we bring it back down to the state level. There's plenty of opportunity for disagreement at the state level. The state legislatures are fully capable of making important decisions about major issues, and there are a lot of issues that just should not be resolved at the federal level. It's bad for the country. With respect to ongoing litigation and the potential for an end run around the APA process, certainly we'll have a lot to see in the next few months with respect to ongoing litigation. We've got a Title IX case that's been up to the Supreme Court once already. There's been a lot more regulatory action, and so a lot more litigation from the states. There are many, many cases hanging out there in many different procedural postures. I will note that one potential answer is if the federal government is unwilling for whatever reason to robustly defend certain things, the states have previously intervened, and there may be an opportunity for the blue states to continue playing defense for a while, even if the federal apparatus switches sides. But we'll undoubtedly be in court quite a bit on these issues going forward, and I look forward to litigating those cases as well. Thank you.
Your last statement actually leads directly into a question that I was going to ask you, but I'd really love to hear a little bit more from your perspective and what all three of you think. And I was going to say, how would you recommend to administration officials that they defend rules that they may actually not agree with in order to let the litigation process play out? I know there, when I was Solicitor General, there were a lot of debates across the country about whether state AGs had the burden of defending state laws, even if they disagreed with them or thought they were unconstitutional. How would you recommend that federal officials go about dealing with those sorts of similar problems here?
Well, I want to be a little careful because as the lawyer on the other side of the V, I'm not trying to tell them what they should do with their cases. I do think that there is an advantage in having the judiciary clarify the actual meaning of statutes that Congress has enacted. If you think about what agencies are doing when they adopt a rule, it looks a lot like a law, and in fact, if you want to challenge it as final agency action under Bennett versus Speer, it has to have legal consequences, but regulations aren't quite laws in the same way that what Congress adopts through bicameralism and presentment is law. Instead, it's actually the execution of the law. And so to continue to execute the law when you have a different vision of what the law actually means becomes a little bit different than saying the General Assembly of my state has adopted a statute with which I have strong policy differences and I don't want to therefore defend it. So I think that distinction can be made. Pulling back out a little bit, part of the role for state litigation in this process is an attempt to push the cart out of the ditch and back onto the road. The first place where states have special solicitude is actually in Article 1. States are given representation in Congress by states. Every state has two senators, and then representatives are allocated based on a population formula. But what happens when that political institution fails? It no longer updates its laws, it never fills in the details, it doesn't actually adequately represent the people in their states, and it can't sort of dig itself out. It lacks capacity in some ways. Maybe new leadership in Congress will change that, but I think in many ways states are turning to Article 3 as an agent of the constitutional regime to push the cart back up onto the road, and I think the way that they can do that is by actually declaring the meaning of what Congress has said and therefore bordering and bounding what the discretion that the administrative state can offer.
I would say two things, and this was informed by, you know, a high-profile case we had in Colorado. You know, we were the first, or my boss was the first Democratic AG that Colorado had in 13 or 14 years, and we had a big case about what's called the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, called Tabor, in Colorado, which really limits the ability of state and local governments to raise taxes in Colorado. My boss was very much policy opposed to it, but we defended it and won in front of the en banc 10th Circuit, the process that led to the adoption of that constitutional amendment in Colorado. And so, like Elliot mentioned, I would really focus on, the advice would be, if it's a process complaint about how things happened and the process was fine, I think we have a duty to defend that because that process cuts across administrations, cuts across policy viewpoint, but where there are elements of policy that are discretionary, I do think it's appropriate for administration officials to say, our policy is now different, we are taking a different position here. But I think it's essential for the rule of law and for the continuity of our government, because all of us want to live both in a state government and in a federal government where we can switch sides, where change can come, where we're not the same year in and year out. And in order for that to happen, I do think there needs to be a willingness to defend a law with which you disagree politically where the process was appropriate. And so I think that's the demarcation line and sort of played out in our offices, where deep disagreements with substance, but a robust defense of the process.
You know, I think for a long time there were very well-established norms governing the inertia that DOJ would carry into ongoing cases, and the department was very reluctant to ever switch sides. And we've seen those norms erode dramatically and abruptly, such that I think it's unrealistic to demand that one side go back. There's an asymmetry in the way that the federal government reacts depending on which party is coming into power. And I think you're gonna see that drive some of the decision making going forward, not just with this transition, but with other transitions where, you know, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. I don't know what the future is going to hold for DOJ, but it does seem like a particularly fluid time because the norms that were ironclad for so long have been broken. And so you can't suddenly turn back to those and say, well, you know, we took it on the chin, but we're going to be extraordinarily formalistic in our approach. And then the next time there's a transition, it's going to be used to the advantage of people who disagree with us. But then when we come back in again, we're going to take it on the chin again and do it the old way. So I don't know exactly what the right approach is. I think it's going to be an important time for the judiciary to ensure that the process, however it's done, is done appropriately. And I would like to talk more about that, but I'd probably say something that would adversely impact our litigation, so I'm just going to shut up about that at the moment.
We're pleased to let you stop there. I'm curious, there's been a lot of talk about, California or Texas using state policies to drive national policies. What about the possibility of Congress actually passing laws in certain areas, whether explicitly or explicitly against those extensions of state policy, or just dealing with an issue set? First of all, do you think that's a solution? And I'm curious if anyone wagers that that might happen at some point.
If anyone wants to bet on Congress passing a law, I will take the other side of that bet.
And I think all of us, despite of our political differences, all of us fundamentally agree with what A.G. Scrimeti said earlier, which is, you know, states have very broad police powers, and any attempt to sort of federalize some issue through preemption or some other doctrine and remove state authority to regulate, I think, is an anathema to all of us. To me, I mean, I'm curious, you know, AG's committee, what you think of. I mean, you know, Tennessee is an important state. I'm from Kentucky. Tennessee is an important state, but it's not Texas, not California. How do you deal with the risk of California or Texas establishing rules that govern nationwide? Like, what's the second order solution there?
So you're undoubtedly going to see so much action on this front in the next few years. Extraterritoriality will probably be multiple panels at this thing in a couple of years. We've already seen it with California. The CARB is hyper-aggressive. We saw it with the pork inspectors. And they are a big state, increasingly small state, but a big state nevertheless. And, you know, they exercise a lot of power over the national economy. And it's not just their size. There's a lot of commerce that comes through California. So when California starts saying you cannot use diesel trucks to come to our ports, that is not an internal issue for California. There is a national security issue there. There is an international and interstate commerce issue there. And I think you're going to see an abuse of state power in areas that are properly federal issues with respect particularly to the regulation of vehicles. And Nebraska has been in the lead on some litigation about this. General Hilcher's out there is very concerned with California's impact on the trucking industry. And I do not think this is the last set of cases that you will see touching on that issue. As states assert themselves more against the federal government, we have to be careful that states don't assert themselves too much against other states. Each state has a role to play within its territory. The Republican form of government clause lets us know that each state will be able to govern itself with respect to things other than the enumerated powers, except as limited by the Bill of Rights. But there are ways that particularly big states can abuse their power at the expense of other states in a way that's not consistent with the constitutional structure. And that is likely the next threat. And legislation would be ideal to say clearly, here is the full extent of the scope that you can regulate vehicles that are essential to interstate commerce that happen to move through your territory. I do not anticipate much legislation moving because it has not for a while. And Congress is a somewhat broken institution. Its legislative function is not what it once was, in part because of the rise of the administrative state, and in part that is a contributing cause of the rise of the administrative state. So I think you're going to see litigation draw lines that would probably be better drawn through legislation, but we cannot be governed by California. We don't get to vote. There was a war we fought a while back about that exact issue. And when somebody outside the scope of your sovereignty starts to micromanage what your people can do, starts to limit their economic opportunities, otherwise infringes on their freedoms and on the ability of the state to govern itself, there's gotta be recourse one way or another, and litigation seems like the most ready vehicle for it. So it's outside the scope of suing the federal executive branch, but I do think we're going to see increasing action on that front. I think it's gonna be really interesting. And if you're a law student, you should probably write something about it because you might get cited by a court.
I agree with all of that. It's a compound wicked problem, extraterritoriality. And there are multiple avenues or channels created by the Constitution to try and head this kind of problem off at the pass, and many of them have gotten clogged or in some way damaged, and you sort of think of what they might be. So first of all, the Commerce Clause was supposed to make uniform commerce regulations, but how do you draw the line between commerce and police power rules? And that's kind of difficult. The Dormant Commerce Clause doesn't really say that in the Constitution, so there's debate about whether it exists. I think the National Pork Producers case is best read as it exists, but only for break glass in case of emergency type situations, and we're not telling you what those happen to be. Then there's the Export-Import Clause, and that has really been underdeveloped scholarship, so yes, call for papers, I suppose. And then you might think about another avenue, and Ohio is involved in some litigation making this claim, which is the equal sovereignty of the states is presumed by the Constitution all throughout the Constitution and reaffirmed in the court's precedents. And so when Congress gives California a special, unique legislative right of way to exempt itself from the uniformity of the Clean Air Act and then to make larger standards than anyone else, that can exert all kinds of power outside of California. Maybe Congress lacks the power to make that particular choice. And then the last thing I'd say is the administrative state does things to the market. Complexity is subsidy. It's something my former boss, Boyden Gray, the late great, used to say is complexity is subsidy. And the complex regulations at the federal level oftentimes are conducive to market incumbents. Larger businesses become more efficient because they can absorb the necessary costs of compliance. And that means that now there's a target-rich environment for a state with market power to exert market power by exerting market power on people who already have market power. So there are only so many automakers. They have to compete in California. They have to listen to the rules that California makes. They can't rely exclusively on the 17 states that are part of Ohio's coalition at the Supreme Court right now on that issue. And so you sort of see how the administrative state itself creates the conditions where extraterritoriality becomes an even more wicked and compound problem. And so I think it's one of those things that you're left with nothing but resort to litigation to deal with that particular issue. If you are truly representing the people in your state and their interests in the political institutions that are state AG's offices, you can't just say, well, that's a problem only for Congress and we haven't developed the legal theory in the academic papers enough to coalesce. We have to take action immediately.
You look like you had something else to say, but I perhaps was wrong. What about the fact that the Supreme Court in recent years has, I think, done some work to cut back on the freewheeling administrative state, whether through Loper-Bright or the kind of emphasis on a robust approach to the major questions doctrine? Do any of you have any thought that this will constrain administrative decision making in any appreciable way that will perhaps lead to less of a need for state litigation? Or do you still anticipate that administrations of all stripes will try to find a way?
I mean, at some point, the Biden administration's been extraordinarily aggressive in trying to regulate, and they have spent a lot of time and a lot of effort putting together, you know, Title IX, for instance, took years, and it's hundreds of pages, and it's very complicated. The rule that they put out was a huge effort, and it took us a lot of work, but not nearly as much work, to get it enjoined. And, you know, I still don't entirely understand what they meant, but we had 9 justices of the Supreme Court say that we were entitled to our preliminary relief there. That's a lot of wasted effort. And so I think you'll see continued efforts to regulate, but I don't know that an administration is going to want to invest as much effort, again, as the Biden administration has, given how unsuccessful so much of that effort was. I mean, yeah, they get to wave the flag on these issues, but you only have so much time in the White House, and if you're going to spend it banging your head against a wall and ultimately leave with the legacy of passing something you feel good about that had no appreciable impact, it's probably not worth it. So we'll keep fighting regulatory fights, but I think the court has created a much different landscape now where the incentive to try to solve every problem through regulation is diminished, where we have a much easier case to make when there's clear overreach. So it will remain a problem, but not nearly a problem of the same magnitude in the long run.
I guess I have a slightly contrary view, which is the political incentives are so great to tilt at windmills and blame someone else for its failure that I think you're going to see I am certain that a number of blue state AGs will file suit over some rollback of regulation in the new administration that will fail. But nonetheless, they get to take credit for standing up to the Trump administration and, you know, get benefit internally. So I guess I'm not so optimistic that cooler heads will prevail. And I also think that there are just as Congress has moved a lot of the hard decisions, we talked about the Waters of the United States rule, from Congress, it's a hard decision, the scope of federal regulation under the Clean Water Act. And rather than say it's going to be this, they moved that to the administrative agency, and we've been dealing with that for years. And it's a similar ability to move the decision-making to the judiciary. Even if the odds are longer, I still think we'll continue to see growth.
There is a robust debate about the scope of relief that courts can offer litigants, including states. Universal or cosmic injunctions, much ink has been spilled on that subject. Universal vacatur to erase rules that are unlawful in some way. I would offer one practical consideration that as long as universal vacatur of rules continues to be the norm in many courts, I think it will reduce the incentives to do omnibus, barn-sized target rules that are ripe for the picking in all of the 94 federal district courts around the country. And I think that's a good thing. I think it would be a good thing if the administrative state did less, let's do sort of a legislative process where we're balancing all the interests of all the political constituents between the virtue signaling and whose ox gets gored and all of that, and put it out there. If you could just wipe that away with preliminary injunction or universal vacatur, that maybe makes agencies more circumspect about what they spend their time doing. And I think the tripartite punch, with the third punch hasn't been landed yet on the administrative state, is first, you say statutes mean what they mean, and you can't sneak elephants into mouse holes, the major questions doctrine. Second, you say statutes can't just be held ambiguous, you have to actually look at the first best meaning of that statute, statutes actually have to have meaning going forward, prospectively, with the death of Chevron. I hope that means that we start to see some definiteness of the maneuverability that administrative agencies have from administration to administration, and some certainty for states and other regulated entities. The third stage, which really hasn't come to bear on this, is what happens when you have a regulation and there's no deference and the statute can't be just held ambiguous, but the statute doesn't specify enough about that. And I think that's where major questions maybe becomes non-delegation. And we'll see what that case involves, but if there's no law to apply without the ability to defer, where does that leave the agency? I think that the presumption of the Administrative Procedure Act and the Constitution it was attempting to serve is negative liberty, that there's negative space into which the states can now regulate, or that no one will be regulated, that there's actually a presumption that absent specificity, there's this novel concept called freedom.
Thank you. I have a few more questions, but I'll ask everyone here to start thinking whether you have questions for the panelists, because we'll move to audience questions, I think, after this one. So speaking of taking a contrary view, there are certainly some people who would critique the more robust approach that many or even most states have been taking with respect to litigation. And I think they might say that states asserting their sovereign interest through litigation rather than through the Senate or other political means actually heightens the power of the judiciary to an uncomfortable extent. What would be your response to that critique?
The judiciary has a role. the constitutional structure contemplates the judiciary as the check on the other branches reaching outside the bounds of their allotted power. And so to the extent that the states aggrandize the judiciary through litigation, if you have a judiciary acting in good faith and within its appropriate lane, to the extent that the judiciary expands its authority to check the other branches, that is part of the dynamic system of checks and balances that we have. And if it takes the judiciary asserting itself more to hold the administrative state in check, that is not a problem. That is a built-in feature of the system. You don't want to empower judges to make up the law, but where there are lines that are drawn within the law, it is the court's role to identify and assert those boundaries. So, if you have the states starting to provoke the courts into policymaking or into putting a thumb on the scales procedurally with respect to certain favored policies versus others they don't like, if the court's not acting in good faith, it becomes a problem. But if you have a court that is principled and committed not to a particular policy outcome, but to ensuring that our constitutional system does not see too much power go to any one particular set of hands. The court should not be a subordinate branch. It's co-equal, and co-equality means sometimes they assert their prerogatives at the expense of the other branches.
I would agree with AG Scrimeti with two, perhaps, exceptions following the rule caveats. One is, I think, to Elliot's point on national or cosmic or whatever you want to call it, injunctions that go beyond the scope of the parties before the court. I think there's an area for abuse and judicial sort of aggrandizement and taking over more of the dispute than they have to make a national policy decision. And the second is what we've talked a little bit about at the beginning, which is the interplay between judicial resolution of regulation and notice and comment, the APA, et cetera. And there are certainly I've been involved in conversations where we have shot down opportunities to try to take advantage of things that would really aggrandize the court's power in cementing a particular rule rather than leaving it to the agency to fix the problem and go through its process to fix the problem. And so with those two caveats, I agree. I think the courts do play an important role, but I think that role becomes, there's opportunity for mischief, particularly with the nationwide injunctions.
Well, yeah, and to be clear, I think nationwide injunctions are problematic. I think the APA is a little different. Vacatur, the appellate review model, Mila Sohani, Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence in Corner Post, I think make some important nuances about the distinctions between what the APA involves and what nationwide or cosmic injunctions involve. I think when it comes to the question of aggrandizing the judiciary, that aggrandizement can come in one of two different flavors, and I'm more concerned about the second one than the first one. One is telling the executive branch that they can't do things that they think they can or want to do. That check on the executive branch worries me a lot less than the judiciary telling the executive branch they must do something that they don't want to do. And I do think that's actually, it's simple, but it's kind of an important distinction between the DC Circuit or another judge saying, no, regulate more and harder, instead of letting Congress, if they don't like the way that the executive branch is enforcing something, using their many tools and many levers, including enacting different language, to make the executive branch do something. And I think that second part is only really pernicious if it starts to also say, not only will the courts not allow the executive branch to do something, we're not going to allow them, we're going to force them to do something else, and we're going to cut the states out of that. And the example on that is immigration to me. I think that our jurisprudence at the Supreme Court on immigration has led us into a real mess in that they say, we can't tell the executive branch to enforce the law that Congress has written because nobody has standing to tell them to do that. But the states can't try and do anything on their own because Congress has sort of swept them out of the process through a massive exercise of field preemption. And so who's really left to enforce immigration? Well, change in presidential administration. That's the only place that the court has really left for political change. And I think that you can see maybe some evidence that If the court is going to use its power to say that's the only channel, then maybe that's what presidential elections start to be about. And so I think that there was an alternative path where the court could have said maybe states do have some residual authority here, or maybe states do have standing to tell the executive branch to enforce the law that Congress has written. But if those two options are closed, in that doesn't necessarily aggrandize the judiciary, but it does aggrandize the importance of the executive.
Thank you. I really appreciate all of your comments, and I'm sure it's inspired a lot of questions, as I said, from the audience. So please, do we know if we have microphones? I'm not getting an answer. So I would say feel free to stand up and give us your question in a full-throated way.
Yes, so my question is, we've spent the last 10 years working on a court solution to the problem of administrative overreach. My question to each of the panelists is, what do you think of the idea that was first proposed about 10 years ago by a team that included Ed Meese for a constitutional amendment called the Regulation Freedom Amendment that would require major new federal regulations to be approved by Congress and defines a major regulation as one that is objected to by a majority of the minority party in either the House or the Senate, which mathematically means 25% of the House or the Senate. And just FYI, 29 state legislative chambers have passed resolutions urging Congress to propose the amendment, but it's never really moved in Congress yet. What's your thought?
I am against constitutional amendments, and the reason is I don't like what they say about the existing document, which I think does, in fact, give us the answers to many of these problems if we have merely the will and the skill to enforce and live up to the republic that we were given. And beyond that, I don't like the idea of constitutionalizing the administrative state in that way, which already exists in sort of a tenuous relationship to say, oh yeah, we're going to basically ratify that administrative regulation is the way that we sort of do anything. I guess I hope for more than that.
I'd just say, as a Coloradan with a 1,000-page state constitution, I cannot be against constitutional amendments. We have several on our ballot every cycle. But I do think part of what the litigation, I don't think it's a good idea for the following reason. I think part of what we see in the litigation is challenging different, the timing and process of rules that are then challenged in federal court. And anytime you create additional process and delay and it's very difficult ex ante to say we're gonna do this way and it's gonna have the foreseeable consequences. I think when we constitutionalize basically a mini APA review process, we're not sure what we're gonna get, and our existing tools, as imperfect as they are, do have some flexibility that allow us to deal with what's coming.
So one of the beauties of our constitutional system is we have 50 laboratories of democracy, and this is actually something that exists in roughly the same form in Tennessee, where the Government Operations Committee reviews every regulation that comes out, every rule that comes out. You know, and it's a great way to see how things operate on a smaller scale. We had an anti-deference law. So when people said that the end of Chevron was the end of the world, I just laughed because we've had the opposite of Chevron and the state is doing great. So we can see how things work. I'd be a little bit worried about implementing something at the federal level because the volume of regulation is so much higher and Congress is already having a difficult time doing anything. So adding something to the congressional plate, I see ways that you could procedurally abuse that if you have a minority party that just wants to clog things up and make life difficult. At the same time, I think it's a recognition that the administrative state in its current form is just not consistent with our understanding of the Constitution. I don't want to issue any pronouncements about absolutely I'd be against it. But I would think things like increasing the size of the congressional staff would be a potentially more modest way of allowing that branch to assert itself more against the administrative state. The Congressional Review Act is a start. There are obviously some problems with that. I worry about constitutionalizing something without really thinking through how it would play out. But the spirit animating that idea, I think, is absolutely right. And at the end of the day, our laws come from the people's elected representatives in Congress at the federal level. And to the extent that they're not involved in that process, it's a problem. And there does need to be a significant solution one way or another.
I think they're asking you to speak up.
Okay. Sue and settle, the last 30 years, has not become just a phenomenon. It's become a state involved the NGOs, and then they get together with the justice, and they settle favorably and give that NGO or the other little groups large amounts of the federal dollar through these kinds of approaches. How do you solve that other than just a new justice?
For anyone who couldn't hear, the general question was, sue and settle has become an important process that a lot of groups are using, and how do we try to cut back on that in order to protect the usual processes in our government? Any thoughts?
The court should be adamant against abusive use of the CyPRE process. We shouldn't be funneling tons of money to politically favored entities. I think to the extent that the government is not providing an adequate defense for laws, there should be opportunities for intervention. I worry about unchecked suing and settling. At the same time, if the federal government transitions and the new boss says, this is blatantly unconstitutional and I do not feel ethically good about my Department of Justice defending this law, I think it's difficult to say you absolutely must. That was the old norm, but it doesn't exist anymore. So. It's a system in flux, but sue and settle and throwing money around to politically favored patronage institutions is awful, and there's got to be some check on that.
I agree. I would just say that picking up on something A.G. Scarametti said earlier, states as interveners, I think, is a underdeveloped part of our national litigation, and there are wildly inconsistent approaches that the judiciary has taken to allowing states to intervene to defend rules or fight a settlement. I think states having an increased role there and a more standardized, particularly at the district court level, because most of these things aren't coming to the court, right? They're going to be decided at a lower court level, and having clear rules there would be quite helpful, particularly on permissive intervention.
I agree that sue and settle is oftentimes pernicious in how it operates as a workaround of the political process. I don't have anything to add on that front. I will say there is some interesting constitutional law to develop about the scope of Article 2 and how much Congress can authorize private party suits under the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, other places like that, how much they can delegate the ability to enforce the law to private parties, whether that's on the criminal side or on the federal side. And a lot of the sort of sue and settle opportunity comes from private attorneys general actions at the federal level, where then the government operates to settle, and then people get a cut of public monies for not really much effort on their part.
Thank you. Any other questions? The question was, to the extent that red states may be likely to have less administrative litigation coming up, what issues, what ways can absorb, what items can absorb that energy at the Attorney General level?
First, I don't know that the decrease in litigation is going to be as pronounced as some people think. There are still a lot of reasons for the red states, who generally care more about state sovereignty in principle, or at least in the past have expressed those principles a lot more clearly. We don't have a parliamentary system. If the federal government, the federal executive branch, is doing something that affects state sovereignty, whether it's a policy we agree with or not, we may have structural concerns about that. There's going to be a robust amicus practice, I have no doubt, in all of the regulatory litigation. There may be there may be a lot more extraterritoriality litigation, and you know, this is another one of those times where I really want to talk but probably shouldn't, but I, you know, there's definitely been conversation about how we might use those resources most effectively.
We'll save you, Mr. Olson.
Yeah, I would agree with AG's committee's first point, which was, you know, just because a state and the national government are of the same party does not mean that there are similar agreements as to who decides what. And speaking as someone who was the SG during both Trump's first term and Biden, there was a lot of work during the Biden administration. It wasn't as, I think we had far fewer lawsuits, but we had some lawsuits, that both that we continued or that we brought on issues that were particular to Colorado. But there's also a lot of debate over who decides what and where the accountability lies. And I think there's, both on the amicus practice and in, it took a lot of work. Not as much of it was filed court pleadings, because people would answer the phone instead of, you know, just responding to something that was in a pleading. But there was a lot of sharp disagreement, and I think particularly not everyone has a similar view of the role of the states, even on the same team.
A lot of that energy will be absorbed in being the laboratories of democracy within the states too. States are innovating in all kinds of areas of policy to the benefit, hopefully, of their citizens. And you know, I would be perfectly content if I didn't sue the federal government nearly so often and instead spent time defending the good work of the General Assembly as consistent with the state constitution. I mean, one example of that is because A.G. Scrimeti's case was a little ahead of us in the Sixth Circuit involving questions of medical treatments for minors that have lifelong lasting effects, people sued over Ohio's law in Ohio's state courts. And so my boss, the Attorney General, said, we're going to do a full trial on the merits. We're going to put up witnesses. We're going to do the fact development. That was time well spent on behalf of the people of Ohio, I think, to ensure that that law that was adopted by the General Assembly gets to continue to govern. And so if there's less work at the federal level, and I think there will still continue to be much of it, as Eric said, amicus briefs and intervention by red states to defend rules that maybe benefit them or align with their view of the structural constitution. But there's also a lot of work to be done confronting the modern issues in the place where those issues are supposed to be confronted, in state legislatures, where the state attorney general operates as their counsel.
That was a really interesting point, I think, that General Scametti made, which is sometimes even if you agree on the policy, you may disagree on whose job it is to make the policy. So I expect we'll see some of that in the next few years. Who knows? What other questions do we have? Yes, you.
Well, as the outsider in the room, I will say we're going to see the same amount of, but it's not just going to be states, right? I mean, there's the small p political benefit for NGOs, whoever, to challenge whatever in court is, even if they lose, is so great that the self, counting on self-restraint, I don't think will matter. I'm interested in seeing, particularly with the development of some of the skepticism towards the administrative state by the Supreme Court over the past, you know, 5 years, you know, where will states where will the blue state sort of focus their energy? Because a lot of arguments that were made 5 years ago, we know will not make it all the way to the end, right? And will the blue state say, we're still going to make these arguments because it's politically valuable for us, or there's some value in slowing down or delaying the implementation of a policy? I'm curious to see how that's going to come out. But there will be a lot of litigation. I don't think there's any reason to think it's not going to be more than before, both because the disincentives are so low, and there were some real successes before that people will want to build on. So I think there'll be more than before. And it's, you know, I mean, I was on a panel with Noel a few months ago, and you know, each of us have our versions of the story, but at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of litigation against the Trump administration, there's a lot of litigation against the Biden administration. Each of us can say, oh, gee, it was, you know, you guys did it to us, so we're gonna do it to you. Counting on, you know, restraint will not carry the day.
To the extent that the amount of litigation starts to infringe on the executive branch's ability to do what it's supposed to do well, I mean, the courts are ultimately going to be the check on that. You could have some procedural changes through legislation, but I'm not optimistic that that's on the horizon. But, I mean, we have a judiciary that I think cares a lot about the longer-term incentive structure and the allocation of authority and the exercise of authority appropriate to the different parts of government. And so if it becomes, and there are multiple issues here. One is just the volume of litigation whenever anybody tries to do anything. I mean, if the federal government, if the president tries to do anything, there's going to be a lawsuit. The degree to which that lawsuit inhibits the workings of the executive branch can potentially be a problem. Lit holds, you know, all the basic mechanics of litigation can be a huge impediment to getting anything else done, and that's a problem. I mean, the president gets elected, the president has a right to do things. So we'll see what happens there. But the weaponization of the government has happened in different ways. The double standard of criminal law enforcement, I think, is probably the single most pernicious thing that we've seen happen. And that, I don't know exactly what the solution is. I think the courts are going to be part of that solution. What you want to avoid is like the death spiral of just the tit-for-tat escalation of using the full might of government for the primary purpose of hurting the people who disagree with you. And, you know, it's been commented many times, but that's how the Roman Republic collapsed. I mean, there was this escalating tit for tat, and eventually it just made more sense to overthrow the thing than to deal with the political fighting. The stakes were too high. So figuring out ways to lower the stakes, to lower the need to fight over this, including by returning a lot of the fights to the states, is a way to accomplish structural change that could reduce the incentives to at least some of that fighting. And then the criminal side, there needs to be transparency in exactly what happened, but there's some things that happened that are just appear to be beyond the pale and completely unacceptable in a functional republic. And we got to find the truth about multiple different instances of that and hold people accountable for it. You know, the answer is not to go after people on the other side who are political actors you disagree with. It's potentially, if something illegal happened, to go after the people who are abusing their authority for political purposes. But one way or another, we need to make it clear, and we need to do it soon, that you cannot use the government as the instrument of petty vengeance. You know, if someone breaks a law, they should be held accountable, but we don't go looking for excuses to use criminal justice authority against people on the primary basis that we don't like them.
I couldn't have said that better myself. Honestly, the banana republic scenario, you know, people say, you know, it makes me think of Sinclair Lewis, it can't happen here, right? Like, no, it can. It can happen anywhere. Human beings have human nature. The descent into, you know, sort of use of power and abuse of power, and the rule of law is precious and rare. It doesn't exist everywhere. It hasn't existed for long swaths of human history. You have to cherish it and uphold it. I mean, I think part of your question involved, you know, the lawfare against the Trump administration the first time around. A lot of that was routine APA litigation. And I think
part of the message there was that you absolutely have to turn square corners, and maybe there is a little bit of a double standard. You have to turn square corners more if you're trying to undo regulation than if you're trying to do regulation. Maybe that standard is sort of changing. You know, judges are not political actors. They do have judicial philosophies, and the shape of the judiciary right now should make one thing abundantly clear to any administration that's coming in, is that if you want to undo something that a previous administration has done, you have to be by the book. Perez, mortgage bankers, undo things the same way that you did things. Don't try to take shortcuts. I think that some of the shortcuts taken at the beginning of the Biden administration successfully evaded judicial review. I would not be so willing to bet on that this time. And so shortcuts are not going to probably be worth it. They'll likely set back the agenda of the current political environment more than if they just turn square corners wherever they can.
I'll give the precursor that I want to make sure that all of our panelists aren't put in a position where they are saying something that's either for or against their own litigation interests. So if comments are short, I think you'll understand their incentives.
We will give the judiciary many opportunities to figure this out.
And as someone who's unconstrained by current litigation, I think... I mean, special solicitude is sort of, in hindsight, a hilarious description of what you're trying to do. Because what it really means that sometimes we're going to say you as a state get to do things that private litigants can't. And it also means that you as a state can't do things that private litigants can sometimes. And so it's obviously very difficult to come up with sort of a one-size-fits-all definition. But I do think, to A.G. Scarametti's point, having more decisions on this by, you know, courts of appeals will help, because it is very inconsistent. And the challenge is creating a playing field where people sort of know the rules going in, and you don't have a lot of people taking flyers. I mean, we would joke on the blue state side of things, you know, the SG's office in Colorado was me and a paralegal. California had, like, you know, 25 people there doing all this work, and we would say, well, you know, I can't just, my boss would say, do this, and I said, well, we got to have to choose, because we can't do all of that. Not all states have the same constraints, and so I think where there's uncertainty, you're going to see people taking advantage of uncertainty. So I just think more opportunities and teeing this up as an important issue that needs to be decided, I think, is the way to do it.
When it comes to standing, I think there's an objective and there's a risk. The objective is that you have clear rules that everyone understands and are easily followed and applied by the judiciary to ensure that courts at the federal level only adjudicate cases and controversies per their constitutional mandate. The risk is that standing becomes a door that swings in multiple places on its hinges and is difficult to predict and understand, and can be used in a way that makes some people somewhere perceive that maybe it comes down to judicial willingness to exercise its unflagging obligation to decide cases within its jurisdiction.
I'll angle over here in case I've missed anyone in this area of the room. Anyone over here?
There's one under the lights.
Oh, great. I'm blinded, so whoever just said hello, you're...
I think there's a lot of opportunity for strategery, but I think the courts, like, There are limits, and we have to exercise good judgment. So there may be some opportunity to do that, but if it gets ridiculous, we're going to get smacked down by the courts.
Yeah, I mean, litigation is important, but restructuring your government to be willing to be able to sue over stuff that may or may not actually happen, I don't think it happens, really, and to the extent that states are doing that, I think maybe those resources could be better spent on something else.
Yeah, I'd agree. The Supreme Court's approach to state standing is, at its most generous, confusing and erratic. And so I think structuring government to take advantage of where we are today is no guarantee of where we'll be down the road. I mean, at the end of the day, you can talk about a consequence to a state for almost any federal action that ever occurs. And figuring out what consequences are going to matter for standing and what consequences are just sort of life in the big city or, you know, in our, you know, 51 imperfect solutions hasn't been done yet and needs to be done. But I wouldn't change any government based on where we are today.
I'm scanning. Last chance for any questions. Well, I think we've had a vigorous discussion, a lot to think about, even some paper topics that I hope a lot of the students and young lawyers and academics in the audience might consider. So thank you very much to all of our panelists today. Thank you.